I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is the Tech Central Show. TCS is brought to you by MTN Business. Visit mtnbusiness.co.za to learn more about their products and solutions. And we thank MTN Business for partnering with Tech Central to bring you these great interviews. My guest today is joining me from Cape Town. He is the co-founder and CEO of a fintech startup that has just raised about R1 billion in a significant Series B funding round led by QED Investors and with participation from a range of new and existing investors. Its customers include the likes of Takealot, MTN, Vodacom, Bash, now a part of TFG, of course, Hollywood Bets and others. The company is called Stitch, and this latest funding round is worth about $55 million in rand terms, bringing the company's total funding to date to the region of about 2 billion rand or $107 million in hard currency terms. Kian Pillay, welcome to the Tech Central Show, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Fantastic. Now, this, Kian, is a very significant funding round, certainly in the South African context, just based on the quantum of funding raised alone. But before we delve into it, tell me a little bit about yourself and your background and what led to the formation of Stitch.
Sure. Yeah, happy to. So I am a South African born and bred, born in Durbs. I grew up in Pretoria, and then I came to study in Cape Town and fell madly in love with Cape Town and have never left. I have always kind of liked tinkering in anything vaguely computer science-y. I was very fortunate that my grandparents got me a computer when I was 10, which was a very strange, random thing to do back then.
What was it?
I can't even remember. It was like an absurdly large box. It had WinMe on it. Like at best, it had paint and a few other things. I spent years just playing with paint as a 10-year-old because that was fun. I spent like an obnoxious amount of time in our study playing with that. It was an absolutely garbage piece of computer, but I think probably set me up in many, many ways. So I'm very grateful for that. I studied computer science and finance at UCT. And then one of my now co-founders, who I've known my whole life, Priyan, who's our CTO, our dads are best friends, so I've literally known Priyan since I was zero. He moved down to Cape Town, and we've always tinkered on things, and we were the two techie guys in our families versus like quite stereotypical Indian families, which are like lawyers and doctors. And he moved down to Cape Town, and we went out for lunch, and we were like, hey, we should noodle on something, and we should, you know, play around with, you know, some new technology, and we should build something on the blockchain. And, you know, we were just excited to build something together, and we thought, hey, how about person to person payments, right? Like how do I pay you back for this meal, right? How do you pay your friend back for pizza, for beers, for coffees, whatever the case is? And it's still like, which is hilarious, but like 5 years later, after finding Stitch, there's still no really easy, simple, fun way to do that in South Africa, which was the premise 5 years ago, but there is in like many parts of the world. That was it. Like very easy. I have Duncan's number. I should be able to send him money. Like not rocket science. But turns out that like moving money piece is really hard, right? We spent, you know, maybe 9-12 months, weekends and evenings while we were both employed elsewhere, just sort of hacking on this. And it's not, you know, the building the app piece that is difficult. It's the moving the money piece, which is, I think, like taken for granted by most consumers, including, you know, myself and Priyan back then. And we even had experience in the financial space, but it's just compliance and banks and treasury and KYC and money laundering. And like you spend all your time doing that versus like, hey, I just wanted to make this delightful user experience to move money. And so we sort of got to the point where we had built our own tech to do that and to like power the application. And we got to the point where we could move money with an API call, albeit probably not compliant and horrible and not scalable, but we got to the point where we had like /bank/payout. And if you hit that endpoint, it made a payment, right? And that was this like really cool moment for us. And we both were like, this would be very interesting if this was real and this wasn't, you know, a dumpster fire that lived on our laptops. And we both quit our jobs at that point. And it's taken, you know, many a turn and morphed a lot. But the idea was like, hey, this would be really interesting for everyone. Anyone that is sort of involved in finances, accepts money, moves money. It's a difficult thing. Like we could make, you know, a product out of this and we can make it a bit more scalable.
What is the most difficult part? Is it getting the technology to work or is it working on, in the regulatory ecosystem?
I would say like all of the above, and there are other pieces too. It's a highly competitive environment, right? There are other people, like people have accepted money online for many, many years. We're not the first people to do this. We won't be the last. I would say the combination of all of the moving parts are quite difficult. You know, the startup adage is, you know, when you're building a startup, you are like building the plane as you fly it, which I always think is such a great analogy. But it just becomes very hard because you can't really mistime any piece of it, right? You need to get customer demand at sort of the same time that your product is getting ready, that a customer can use it. But, you know, there's another vector, which is like you are regulatory ready and compliant. And then there's another factor. There's a bank that's willing to work with you. And it becomes this like very challenging, interesting coordination problem where if you sort of get one of those things wrong, it's pretty detrimental, right? Like if you don't have a customer, then the bank's not going to work with you. And if you don't have a bank, the customer won't work with you. And if you don't have a bank and a customer, you won't get a regulator to approve it, right? And if you don't have any of those things, then you can't build the product. And so the moving pieces of it is quite challenging, and we haven't always timed it perfectly. And we have had laggy periods where we've had one ahead of other, but it's mostly humming now.
Well, let's talk about funding. You've obviously just done this big funding round, but let's go back to the beginning. You quit your day job to start this business or to build it. Where did your first bit of funding come from? Was it angel investors? How did you raise cash initially?
Yeah, we've been super fortunate with this. Our first funding came largely from the investors of the last business I worked at. So I worked at a business called Smile Identity, which you know operates in the African fintech and startup space. It's an identity verification provider, similar sort of thing as to what we're trying to do, but you know, verifying identity versus moving money type of thing. Was based in San Francisco, now based in London, but very traditionally venture capital backed. I was fortunate enough to spend a good amount of time with the investors at that business while I was still there. And so they all knew me. I knew the founders very well, obviously. It was an 8-person company when I was there. And so I had very good relationships and fortunate enough to still know them well now and also left on good terms. I was really enjoying it. And one day I told my boss, who is the COO, hey, I'm resigning. And things were going well. I was enjoying it. The business was doing well. And he said, what? Like, what's going on? And I said, like, genuinely nothing wrong with Smile. I just have the bug. I kind of just want to do something else. I have such a great relationship with him and I'm very, very grateful for everything he's done for me. And he's like a serious father figure in my eyes. And he said, no, is there nothing we can do to convince you? And I said, no, seriously, I just have the bug. And then he said, okay, how much can I invest? Before even hearing the idea or anything, I was like, oh, like, okay, Dad, like, sure, this is great. And so I was super fortunate that he was keen to put some money in, him and the founders. Also introduced me like more formally to all of the other investors. And they said, hey, Kian's leaving. We're going to invest. You guys know him. You guys should take a look at this and maybe put some money in. And so we're so fortunate that we were able to quite quickly put some money together. And it's one of those really powerful things that I don't think has quite proliferated throughout Africa or South Africa and stuff. But it is a very common like Silicon Valley story where you know, you just, you know, someone who knows someone and, you know, there's a good reference and you can put something together and someone will take a bit of a punt on you. So we're really fortunate it happened that way.
Okay, fantastic. So take us very briefly then through the timeline of fundraisings that you've been through since your founding in 2019. You've been through Series A and Series B now, but just run us through that quickly.
Yeah, we've had a few of them. So, looking back, we sort of put titles on all of these things, which we maybe didn't do when they happened. But yeah, I would call the first hit of funding our pre-seed, which was a few $100,000, from this group that I just mentioned. Now we raised it in about November 2019. Not knowing what was about to hit us, right? COVID was around the corner. We raised money, and then 2 months later, COVID hit. I think we're fortunate enough to basically raise money sort of every year, almost exactly, year on year until where we are now. About a year later, I would say we had proven, and so, probably quite stereotypical to each stage, but the pre-seed investment was, this is this kooky idea, could be interesting, bunch of wacky characters, let's give it a punt, right? And it's that, right? It's like, it's a complete punt, like chances of zero are very high. Maybe a year later, we raised a seed round. We were quite fortunate to get some international people involved and like a slight increment to that, right? Like we built a little bit of tech. It's interesting, clearly a clever team and can build technology. Unclear whether anyone wants it, unclear whether you could scale it, whatever. So we raised about $6 million there. And it was to say, hey, let's like really give it a chance. They have, you know, some chops. Then we raised in 2021, again, about a year later. And this one was maybe the kookiest of them all. And I think really sophisticated investors and really interesting group of people involved and stuff. But I think the whole world, including us, got very caught up in like the last frontier in venture capital, right? And it's like Africa. And like, what could a pan-African payments business look like? What could a pan-African data business look like? And like, we were not even doing well in South Africa at the time, right? We were still like barely finding our feet there. And so we were very fortunate that you know, we raised a large amount of money. We raised $21 million at that point. And I'm still grateful for it to this day, because I think we needed a little bit of extra capital, because it did take us long to find our feet. We only maybe started to get traction in like mid 2022. But really that was predicated on like, how could we be this pan-African business? And somewhere along there, we did expand into Nigeria for 3-4 months, and it was an absolute disaster, and we had to pull out. And so that was sort of, the start of our Series A. Then maybe about like 18 months later, so maybe this one is slightly more prolonged, is actually when we started to get traction. We had started to get traction as a pay by bank method, right? We were a payment method. We weren't a full suite payment service provider. We were just offering one thing to a group of people. But a few things were interesting. I think one was that we were attracting quite a lot of interest from enterprises. They were starting to want to work with us on multiple products. And that was compelling too. Like one, it was an interesting customer set, because these are large businesses that you could potentially scale with for a very long time. And two, they're interested in things you're not even doing yet, right? Like products that they already have in the market. They were like, hey, could you guys maybe look at doing that for us? Which is also was non-obvious to me, right? If you had told me 4 years ago, we would be competing and, you know, providing card payments and things that existed in the market, I would have said, why, right? There's like 3-4 other players. And so that funding round was $25 million. Ribbit led that round, who are globally one of the most renowned sort of fintech investors, which we're very happy with. And we've had a relationship with them for a while. And then now about a year after that, we raised this round now with QED, which was $55 million. And that's sort of to fund some of our future growth now.
Okay. And I noted that Trevor Noah is one of the participating angels, if I can call him that, in the latest funding round. How did that happen?
Yeah, good question. He is, and we're also smitten about that. I think it's like one of these weird things, and it doesn't really happen often in South Africa, and I'd love that to change. Is we one of our angel investors is quite a prolific South African guy that lives in Silicon Valley now. And he's just very, very connected. And, you know, as you do when you're that sort of profile, I think he's very, very generous with his network. And he's like, I know these South Africans doing things and you guys should connect. And, you know, Trevor's looking to do more stuff in South Africa. And he's obviously, you know, very romantic about South Africa and he's spending more and more time there. And it was really one of these, like, you know, ridiculous connections where I say ridiculous because we benefited from it so much. Benefited from it so much. Was he was literally just like, hey, you're two South Africans. This could be interesting. You could do something together. I'm sure you'll just enjoy talking to each other. Like, connect. And I was like, whoa, did I just get connected with Trevor? No, that's awesome. And yeah, I think, you know, it's always very pleasantly demystifying sometimes when you meet these people and they're so down to earth and very relatable and easy. And that was kind of it. And so, like, I have a bunch of stories that would be similar to that, but with, you know, people in tech and fintech and stuff like that. But it's just like such a wonderful thing that people do in some of these markets where they just want to give back because people did it to them, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. So is Trevor very much a passive investor or is he giving you some ideas for the business as well?
A bit of both. We, like, historically, Stitch has not been a consumer-facing brand, right? Like, we are now, you know, one of the largest PSPs in South Africa. We do a very significant amount of volume online. Actually, chances are, if you're a South African that's paid online, chances are you paid in Stitch. If you ask any South African what Stitch is, you know, chances are they'll have no clue, right? Which I totally understand because we've never been a consumer-facing brand. At some point, there is merit and value in building that out. At the early stages, that's very expensive and it's unclear whether you should spend the money up front, which was sort of our thesis. Now, like, the larger we get and we do compete against other PSPs that I would say do have better brand equity than us, I think there is merit to being like, how do we win the consumer at checkout, right? And that's where we'd like to start having a little bit more fun and getting more involved in more consumer-facing stuff. I think that will be a while away still, but I think increasingly there'll be more involvement.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm sure Trevor Noah will be able to help you out enormously there if he's willing to. So you mentioned the other players in the PSP space. It looks like a very competitive market to me as an outsider. There seem to be a lot of players in that space in South Africa. What are you doing differently compared to the other guys that has caught the attention of your funders?
Sure. I think that your observation is bang on, right? I thought this. I thought, like, absolutely. When we had enterprises say, can you do our card transactions? Can you do payouts for us? It's like, what do you mean? Like, you have someone doing that for you. You're like, you've been doing this for 10 years. How, like, what are you looking for? And I think there's just this pretty interesting gap in being quite specialized. Right. I think most providers, including us, or us at the start, are, and this isn't to be critical. I think the market is such that you do want to go after the whole thing. It's not the stakes in terms of like size, for example. But to a little extent, they're all things for all people, right? Like, you can serve a mom and pop clothing shop. You can serve sort of like a mid-level e-commerce shop, or you can try serve like the largest enterprises in South Africa. And like, to some degree, you just can't serve those businesses the same way, right? And if you have all of your like tech, your operational functions, your onboarding, your support, your fraud, they're all kind of operating to serve all people, it gets a little bit bloated and inefficient in some areas. And I think it's very difficult to be as responsive to the enterprises as you need. So in 2022, we actually made a really hard decision to offboard all of our non-enterprise clients. And the reason just being like, hey, there is certainly enough volume and opportunity in South Africa to just serve enterprises and you can build an interesting and big business here, but you have to be the best at it, right? You have to be able to respond, you know, within 5 minutes. You have to be able to like meet them where they are with all their custom requirements. you can't operate support as like a call center. You need to be like humans, white glove. And so I think there was just like quite a gap to serving enterprises in this like best in class way. You know, I would be lying if I said we did all things in market as well as all other PSPs. And I'd like to get there, and we'd like to expand to do these things. But our gap right now is enterprise. And right now, I think we do significantly perform better on an enterprise basis than other players. And that was sort of like the niche that we just wanted to carve out.
Out of interest, do you see other fintech players as your primary competitors, or do you see the banks as your rival?
It depends. It's a good question, and it changes a bit over time. I would say predominantly what it has been is the fintech players, right? And it's the other PSPs, and like those are more obvious competitors, right? You go to a merchant and you say, hey, I'm selling card payments. And they say, hey, yeah, I use competitor X, right? And that's an obvious one. Like increasingly, I would say the lines sort of blur between what banks can do and what fintechs can do. And I think that's happened in like many markets in the world. And that's beginning to happen in South Africa, right? There's a new payments bill that's coming out that in South Africa that increasingly grants PSPs similar access, similar rights, you know, direct integrations into the clearinghouse and stuff that some of the banks have. And so I would not say we're competitors with the banks yet. I don't think we will be for a very long time. I don't think it's unfeasible to say that like our paths will sort of blur and overlap a little bit in that case. And, you know, banks are starting to offer direct payment methods, right? And like, what does that mean, right? It means like we can distribute them, and that's very interesting, and we can be partners there. They can distribute them directly, and that, you know, we'd be competitive on who we're selling to in some cases, right? In many cases, what we're doing is our underlying products are, you know, bank-owned and bank-sponsored. We're not able to hold deposits. Banks hold deposits, right? And so we are partners with the banks in many cases, but who wants to own the customer at the end of the day? And so, like, it's an outrageously stupid word, but people throw around the word co-opetition when it comes to banks and fintechs. And I think that's probably true, right? And I think that can be healthy. It can also be very friction-filled, depending who you work with. But there will be some case, I think it would be a bit short-sighted to paint any one of them with a single brush and be like, these banks are our competitors, or these banks are our partners outright. I think some things you'll partner with, some things there might be competitive elements, and that will change over time, you know, based on the market dynamics.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Now, a lot of PSPs in this market are focused or started out focusing on the e-commerce space, either mainly or exclusively, but I believe your offering's broader than that. In fact, you bought a company a few months ago called Exipay to allow for in-person payments. Maybe take us through that and the full payment offering that you offer to the market.
Yeah. I mean, I think we started similarly. Obviously, e-com is a very fast-growing space. It hasn't really slowed down in the last few years. And you know, if you look at the volumes in South Africa, e-com is about 10% at best of total volume, whereas in-person payments is still about 90%, right? But you look at some, you know, Western markets, in many markets that's flipped, right? Like e-com is like 60% and in-person is 40%. You know, I don't know when that will happen in South Africa, but you have to believe at some point in time that shift will change. So online is very compelling to us. But, you know, where is the volume today? Like plain and simple, it's in person, right? Like again, 90%+ of volume is in person. Who are the businesses we're working with? We're working with the large South African enterprises, which are telcos, they're retailers, like all of these businesses, the same dynamic supply, right? So we're serving them online. That's great. We're a trusted partner now. It's growing fast. But you have this dynamic where all of a sudden, you know, online payments have become big enough that these businesses are paying attention to them. You know, a few years ago, they were 1% of their total volume. So they're like, whatever, you can have this little ragtag team doing whatever you want. You have your own little sandbox, go play in it. And then we'll do the in-person stuff, right? But now you have this world where like online is growing so fast that it's pretty hard to look at them separately. So now people are starting to say, okay, what does omni-channel look like? That's the really hot buzz term, right? And it's like, how do I combine my in-person payments with my online? First of all, I have completely different teams working on these two things. That probably doesn't make sense. I need to have reconciliation in one place, settlements in one place. How do I get one single view of what my payments looks like, what my revenue looks like in one place? And that gets really hard if you're using multiple payments providers, right? And so the thesis was, hey, we have a lot of these enterprises working with us online. They want to start working with us in person. How do we do that? And we went down, you know, classic build, partner, buy type of story. And we've always been of the belief that we want to completely own the stack because we believe we can have better performance if we own the whole thing. And then two, if we completely own the stack, then we're able to offer these unified experiences, right? You're able to start a journey online and you can finish it in person, right? You could refund it in person, or you could pick up your items in person or something like that. Or you can go in person, you can try buy, you know, a pair of nine shoes. They don't have it, but they can deliver it to you tomorrow, right? And you can start your journey in person, but you can finish it online. And increasingly, you know, like merging these two worlds together adds a lot of value to one, how frequently customers are able to transact, but they transact with larger volumes too, right? Because they have more comfort that they can do it between the two. So that was it, basically. It was, we really, really liked the tech that the ExitPay team had built. They were already working with some of the retailers in person that we were working with online, and we thought it was an interesting opportunity for us to marry the two. And that's just where the major volume is. So let's just double down on the existing customers we have and go to where their volume is.
Mm-hmm. Not being an expert on the space, I don't quite understand how the integrations work, et cetera. So if you walk into a store and the transaction goes through your platform, do you have some sort of software that's running on the point of sale device? How does it actually work in practice?
Bang on. So it, essentially the way it works is that we have, I mean, think about it very simply as devices these days are largely Android devices, right? So think of it like more or less like a cell phone, like an Android device. And like you would on a cell phone, you have apps. We have a payments application. So we do have a piece of software on the device. We just are responsible for receiving that payment in a secure way, tracking the reconciliation, make sure it gets to the bank, et cetera. It works exactly like that. It's very analogous to just using an app on your phone.
Okay. And I see you have full support for digital wallets as well, your likes of Apple Pay and Samsung Pay and Google Pay. Was that a considerable amount of work you had to do there, or was it pretty easy to plug into their APIs?
No, it's quite tricky. I think increasingly it could be easier in some markets, but all of these things operate slightly differently in each geo based on restrictions, regulation, the way that they've rolled out their developer experience, etc. So it took us probably longer than we would have liked to get Apple Pay, Google Pay, Samsung Pay live. And we are the first people in the market to offer all three, which we are very happy with. We thought it was a no-brainer, though, right? Like, at least anecdotally, if you walk around, you see a large number of people paying with their phones versus their physical cards, right? So that's interesting. There's already adoption in South Africa of digital wallets. But why is no
COVID
one doing
drove
it?
That, right?
Which, and COVID, it was a huge drive of that, right? And so even just like without being too intelligent, there's like that anecdote. And then you're like, okay, interesting. People are using these things. Why would they not use it online, right? This is like a very proven high adoption, high conversion method everywhere else. So we've rolled that out now. We have it across some of the really large e-com players right now. And in many cases, the volume is creeping up on being larger than total card volume, or it's already larger than total card volume, which is really interesting to see like how quick adoption is given, you know, it's still quite a nascent method.
I use Samsung Pay on Take a lot. Is that your work?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Good. Works seamlessly. I wanted to ask you about fiat versus crypto. You mentioned earlier on that you'd done some work on the blockchain. I don't know if you're still doing work on the blockchain side of things, but what do you see as the opportunity for Stitch in the crypto space, if anything?
Yeah, it's a good question. We think there's a lot of opportunity. We think it's a very interesting mechanism for efficient payments. We think it's an interesting store of value. We think it's driving adoption really quickly. We do have a pay with crypto product, which allows users to pay with crypto, but the merchant can just receive their fiat. So the merchant says, I want 100 grand. The user can put, you know, X equivalent in Bitcoin or whatever they want, and the merchant will still get 100 grand. We have rolled that out to a few merchants. It's an interesting product. The adoption is not absurd, right? I think realistically, the number of people that want to transact with crypto just isn't there yet. But we do believe it'll continue to grow. And we do believe there's increasingly an interesting B2B use case for these sort of things, and not only looking at it from a purely consumer lens. So we're continuing to do a lot in the space and invest a lot in how we're thinking about it. I don't know if we'll see like mass adoption from a consumer perspective in the next 2 or 3 years, but like I think we're well positioned to get there or to have a majority of that volume flow to us once it does happen.
But it's a space you feel you need to be in.
Definitely. Yeah. I think it's one of those things that just could change so quickly if you are not able to keep up with it. We could start to get displaced by like a new upstart, right? If that is like where consumers and the trend and the zeitgeist sort of goes and we are not able to adapt with it, very easy for us to lose share as quickly as we've gained it.
What are the financial sector regulators saying about the integration of crypto into the South African payments platforms? Do you see any pushback at all? Do you see support from the regulators to do this sort of innovation?
Yeah, I actually have been pretty pleasantly surprised from call it the last 2 years. One is that there was a circular that was released, I think maybe 1.5 or 2 years ago, where one, historically, banks have not wanted to bank crypto players, right? Due to risk and ick factor and whatever you call it, and some reasons valid, some maybe too knee-jerk. And there was a circular that went around, and I'm like being exceptionally reductive, but essentially it said, no, you need to bank crypto players, right? You need to like bring them into a more formalized system so we can get visibility and oversight and we can start to regulate. And like by not allowing them to enter the system, it's causing more issues. So I thought that was really positive. And unwarranted is the wrong word, but like there wasn't like any major reason for them to have done that, which I thought was really good. It was like really forward thinking. And then two, now there's a license, right? Like last year, the FSCA released what's known as a CASP, a crypto asset service provider license, and they've made it regulated. And they made it regulated on a case-by-case basis, which is really interesting. You just don't get this broad thing. It's like, what are you doing with crypto? How are you working with crypto? What are your clients? What are your use cases? What are your controls? How do you KYC people? How do you like prevent money laundering? And on a case-by-case basis, they will grant you a CASP. One, I think it's a really interesting thing for consumers because you know which businesses you could trust more, right? They have these licenses. Mm-hmm. They've been approved. It's interesting for businesses as well. But two, it also just gives you strong foundation and guardrails as a business. You're like, this is what I know I'm allowed to do. Here are my bounds. This is what I can't do. If I want to change my scope, I can go and apply again. I can get an amendment. But it's really forward thinking. There's a few markets in the world that are doing this, but definitely not all of them. And I've been like pretty pleasantly surprised that South Africa is one of them. We have a CASP. We got our CASP last year. It was a rigorous process, right? It wasn't like a Mickey Mouse full out of form. Like it was very serious and very, very in depth. So yeah, we were very happy when we got it, but we were pleased at sort of the level of rigor.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. Kian, how big is your team now? You issued a photograph with the press release you put out last week about the latest funding round. Your team, I think it was on top of Signal Hill in Cape Town.
It was.
It looked like a pretty large team. How many people are working for you now?
We're about 130.
130 people. Okay, that's a big team for a startup. Yeah,
it's pretty big. Yeah, feels gigantic. Yeah.
Just lastly, then, you mentioned you had a disastrous, I think it was your choice of word, for your entry into Nigeria. Yeah. What happened there? Which markets are you operating in now? And what are your expansion plans going forward?
It's nothing revolutionary. And probably if you told most people that Stitch, the South African payments business, you know, that has no Nigeria experience, is going to expand into Nigeria, they would have told you how it ends, and it is how it ended. Many reasons, right? We expanded with our pay by bank product into Nigeria. One, I think we just didn't have product market fit. It's a very different market. Like, a lot of the value prop we added in South Africa, such as being able to identify who the user was making the payment, such as making payments real time, That's all existed on NIBS, which is the national payment system in Nigeria for 10 years, right? So we came in and we were like, oh, we have all these sexy things. And everyone's like, no, you don't. Like, these have been here forever. Very localized market, right? So the way consumers act is very different. There is an element to which is difficult to do business just culturally. You do need to approach things differently. We didn't have a huge local team, which is obviously really important in any market. So largely, I think, like, wrong place, wrong time, wrong product. I think we needed to be a lot more thoughtful about it. And, you know, we tried to be. I don't think it was, like, entirely unintelligent how we entered. But it's just a really tricky thing to do. And to be honest, we had competitors doing similar things to us in that market that were from Nigeria, right? And it's like, another, you know, like, what do we know versus the Nigerian founders that have lived in the market their whole life? And, you know, largely that was true, right? We knew much less than them. So that was that. Our expansion plans are largely South Africa. We've been fortunate to get Square with our investors that, one, there is a large enough opportunity to keep going deep and wide here. So that is primarily our plan. We do a few things out of South Africa, but, you know, in quite early ways so far. We will look to do more, but I would say I don't think you'll find us replicating Stitch in any other market, right? It took us 2-3 years before we got the licensing, the product, the tech, the state it could be to operate like a first-in-class PSP. I think there are, like, many, many financial opportunities and business opportunities in other markets, but I would say they look very different to what we're doing here. So we're a bit opportunistic on going where customers are and what some of the demands are, but it doesn't look anything like what Stitch would be here. We wouldn't try to do like Stitch in Nigeria or Stitch in Kenya or something like that. I largely think that's very difficult to pull off, and I'm not certain we have the skill set yet.
Okay. Well, best of luck in your future endeavors, and congratulations on this huge funding round. Kian Pillay is co-founder and CEO of Cape Town headquartered fintech Stitch. Thank you so much for speaking to the Tech Central audience today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, Doug. This is great.